In 2009, I was a firsthand witness to the shooting at Fort Hood, and that really allowed me to connect and empathize even more with my patients. And I think in that, I started giving myself permission to feel the feelings that I was feeling and to acknowledge that I needed support in dealing with that. And then also, I think again that shame is so heavy, and I don't think we always recognize or acknowledge until something else acts as the catalyst. And I think many of us go to marriage counseling or therapy to try to make our marriage work, and I'm doing this with air quotes. And it isn't until we're in the depths of it that we realize that that one question is really opening a can of worms. And that can of worms is going to require, if you're willing, a lot of commitment and a lot of self-exploration.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. Hey, everyone, and thank you so much for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Today's guest is Christina. Christina Hudson helps women break cycles of toxic and traumatic relationships so that they can cultivate healthy love that lasts. She is a best-selling author, podcast host, speaker, and coach. Christina went from being an occupational therapist specializing in brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder in the military to helping women discover their resilience and confidence after trauma. Through her podcast, mentoring, and speaking, she guides women through the process of self-discovery so that they can confidently and courageously create the life they deserve. She believes that we aren't here to merely survive, but we are all meant to thrive. Christina, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Rachel. It's such an honor to finally connect with you.
I know we've been chit-chatting for, it feels like, I think it's been over a year now, honestly, about finally connecting and doing a podcast episode together. And I've just loved seeing your journey through the eyes of social media. We've never met in person, but social media is such a powerful thing, especially in the field of mental health and the work, just seeing what other people are doing to truly make the world a better place for people that have dealt with trauma and mental health challenges and all the things in that world. And so I'm going to pass it off to you to tell the listeners more about your story.
Amazing. Thank you. Yeah, and honestly, there's a lot. And so what I think makes the most sense is really telling a little bit about the story that the book encompasses. It does talk about breaking cycles. So I do talk about my experience in my relationship and ending a toxic turned violent marriage. And the way that in my healing journey, I started understanding how there were a lot of unhealed wounds, hurts, whatever you want to define them as, from my childhood that were really acting as a disservice, I guess, when it came to my adult relationships. And I mean that, you know, even in my healing journey, which is ongoing and will forever be, I have not only found a new way to relate with intimate partners and in that intimate relationship, but also the way that I relate to family, the way that I relate to other women. I think so often too, we really underestimate the ways in which we were raised as kids and the way that, at least through my experience and what I've had in other conversations with other women, is almost like the beliefs that we grew up with as girls and how they impact our relationship with other women and how much peeling those layers back too, so that we can be more in that collaborative empowerment space rather than the competitive space that I think so many of us experienced as girls. But I know that's very high level. What I will say is, yes, I was working as an occupational therapist. I specialized in brain injury and PTSD within the military. And so I had this very niche clinical perspective around, mental health and trauma and seeing soldiers come back. I primarily was working with Army, but I worked with all branches and seeing the individuals come back from combat. And I think it just, is so different because it's not a one-time incident that creates this sense of trauma. It's compounding day after day after day, and often for years, whether it's over in, the field in combat or the cumulative effects at home too, particularly when things go unaddressed. And I think in part, because there is stigma, right? And there is a fear of admitting potential weakness or feeling broken and having to admit that and the shame that comes with that, as well as, particularly within the military, a lot of times admitting that meant no longer being able to work in your role. And so I saw that day in and day out, and yet I never allowed the consideration of how the various traumas I had experienced were impacting me. And in 2009, I was a firsthand witness to the shooting at Fort Hood. And that really allowed me to connect and empathize even more with my patients. And I think in that, I started giving myself permission to feel the feelings that I was feeling and to acknowledge that I needed support in dealing with that. And then also, I think again, that shame is so heavy, and I don't think we always recognize or acknowledge until something else acts as the catalyst. And I think many of us go to marriage counseling or therapy to try to make our marriage work, and I'm doing this with air quotes. And it isn't until we're in the depths of it that we realize that that one question is really opening a can of worms. And that can of worms is going to require, if you're willing, a lot of commitment and a lot of self-exploration.
Well, that's incredible. And I love how you said that you have the two different experiences, like one from a clinical perspective and then one from a self-reflective perspective, because I don't think a lot of people get that. And also the other side to that is that, I think people often forget that people that work in the field of mental health also have their own traumas and mental health challenges that they have to work through, and obviously on varying levels. So as far as the Fort Hood thing, that I would love to dive a little bit deeper into, if that's okay with you. Take us back to that. What was that experience like for you? And if you don't mind telling us, what happened from your standpoint that day, and then the support afterwards that you received.
Yeah, I detail this a little bit in the book. Because we were on government grounds and it was a big military issue, ordeal, whatever you want to define it as, there was a lot of silencing, I guess, that came after the fact. Like I said, was working as an occupational therapist. I was in what was called our mild traumatic brain injury clinic, and had a patient in my office with me at the time. And we heard the gunfire, and he was quick to take action and quickly became very protective of me and was really guiding me in, where I needed to go, where I needed to place myself, how we were going to protect ourselves. And so that was a really supportive, if you will, experience. I was experiencing that with another person. And we had Hassan walk right by my window, right as we were trying to get out of my window. So we came back in, and it just like it really unfolded in so many ways. And I think one of the maybe a couple of the most challenging experiences with that, and then I can highlight some of the positives. One was our building was never breached. And even though we were part of this four building compound where he was shooting individuals, and even though he tried getting in our building, and for whatever reason, for whatever blessing, whatever was happening, somehow every door around our building was locked. So he was not able to get in. And so that was the first of many instances where we were invalidated and denied for the experience that we had. And then because our building was not breached, we too were not considered quote unquote victims. So we were not given passes, if you will, to attend the memorial. And it was just this really interesting evolution and how much people had to fight and prove that we were firsthand witnesses that, yes, nobody died in our building. However, people's bodies were around our building. And, you know, I've really come to understand, and then with this process of going back through my childhood, how much invalidation leads to re-traumatization. And I think that was one of many missteps within the military. And if anybody was familiar with that incident, you would also know that it was originally considered workplace violence. It took them quite a while to change it to terrorism. And that had a big impact on how the soldiers who were involved were treated and what they experienced afterwards too. So it was a really interesting experience. We ended up actually never going back into our building. We did go one time to go get our our necessities of our belongings. We had a lot of counterparts who left their purses and, you know, a lot of their most personal items in the offices. And so we had a couple of hours one day where we were allowed to go clear our stuff out, and we never went back. I think, you know, similar to 9/11, the community of support that was created within our clinic was really something beautiful, both with the other staff as well as the veterans. They were soldiers, the soldiers at the time. And so I say veterans because I've been working with them for the last 10 years. But yeah, so I think the camaraderie, the support that came with that after the fact, and then once I think more was acknowledged about the situation, that was one event, again, that I speak to in the book where I felt safe enough to claim that as trauma, whereas some of these incidents of childhood abuse or other things that happened, I never really felt right labeling them with those terms.
I'm glad that you talked about the invalidation and how that can re-traumatize, because I think that's a theme in, I mean, across just the military mental health system in general, is that the idea, and really just military leadership in general, is this concept of invalidation, because it kind of crosses that thin line between, you know, be tough because you're in the military, there's a job to do, versus like, these are still human beings that deserve to be validated and helped, because everyone has their own stuff that they bring into military service with them, mentally, emotionally, et cetera. As far as Fort Hood goes, it sounds like Fort Hood has been kind of a topic of conversation over the last few years, as far as, you know, the toxic things that have happened there. Talk to us about the environment in general on that base, and I'd love to hear prior to, and you talked a little bit about after that incident, prior to that incident, and then any other things that you want to highlight. Are there any things that really stood out to you about the culture on that base in general? Or I guess to reword that slightly, like what was the culture like? Did you get a feel that it was a toxic culture? Did you feel like it was a supportive culture, or maybe somewhere in between where it was just kind of neutral and it wasn't really affecting one way or the other?
I think it kind of depends on the clinic that I was in. And again, being a therapist, and we actually were standing up the TBI clinic at the time. So that was a new group of people newly coming together. Many of us were contractors there. When I was working in the occupational therapy clinic prior to that, most were active duty soldiers that I was working with. So there was definitely a variance with the staff. I don't clearly remember so much about the environment itself. However, I will say within the brain injury clinic, I was so unhappy at work and with my job, and a lot of it because of the environment, that I had actually put in my resignation and was supposed to be leaving that Friday. So the shooting happened on Tuesday. I was supposed to leave on Friday. And as one can imagine, I was not in a state to leave because I needed people to support me who knew what I was going through.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how did you personally get to the point after realizing there were all these traumas that, you know, from your childhood and from this incident and things that you personally needed to work on for yourself and your own mental health? How did you get to the point to where now you are able to work with people like you do in the capacity today? Was there a coaching experience, therapy, or maybe a multitude of experiences and tools that helped you out? I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I don't think there's one answer. I will say it's been really interesting because, you know, as somebody goes through school to be a therapist, we are very much taught to create boundaries. You know, you don't take any of their stuff home. I mean, I don't mean like tangible things, but I mean, you know, whatever they're experiencing, it's taught to us that you will burn out. A lot of us, you know, as humans have our own things that we're dealing with, families and home situations, whatever it might be, that if you're always taking that from every single patient, you're going to be completely run down. And so we're taught a lot of skills and strategies to stay separated from that, disconnected in a way, and, you know, taught to leave work at work. And that doesn't always happen. There are certain patients that you feel more connected with or whatever, but I feel like I got really good at that. So I think that even before I had really started working on my healing journey, that was something that I was still very well equipped. And I wasn't recognizing my own traumas coming up in those situations. I think really a lot of my own history of trauma influenced my personal relationships. And I think in part too, we get really good at putting on a mask at work, you know, and we can kind of step into this persona of being a professional. Of, I always felt like I needed to look more mature, speak more maturely, because I look much younger than I am. And a lot of people didn't take me seriously. So I feel like that early on, that really created more or less of this, you know, pseudo me in the workplace. It was very different than how I was at home.
So then a follow-up question to that, did you feel like learning to compartmentalize your feelings, do you think that that served you in a more positive or negative way?
Ooh. I think for those purposes, it was positive. I think as part of the work I've done, I have become very skilled at dissociation, and my therapist recognized that even from childhood. And that has been something that I think makes it incredibly difficult to process and work through a lot of the past.
Thank you for that. And so, when did you start doing therapy yourself, and how did you find a therapist that you felt was a good fit for you?
I love that you're highlighting this. One, I am very rare, I would say. My mom started me in therapy when I was 3, because of my parents' divorce. And so I feel very fortunate that I have been in and out of therapists' offices. And I think that makes it much easier for me to talk about things. I think what people come to realize is, again, when it comes back to that dissociation, I can talk all day and I'm disconnected from the emotion. And so when it comes to the actual healing work, that is not the most beneficial. So I would say I've been in and out of many, many, many therapist offices. And what I've come to realize is, as with anything else, you're going to mesh with people and you're not going to mesh with people. And in order to do this deep work, you have to be able to get very vulnerable. And that means you have to feel very safe and comfortable with your therapist. And it's not always easy to figure out if they're a good fit at first, but I would highly recommend that if there's ever a time that you don't feel comfortable with your therapist, like truly uncomfortable, like you don't feel safe sharing, your situation, or you feel like they're judging you, or I mean, I've just had people make the strangest comments sometimes, and you really need to trust yourself in that and know that that relationship is likely not going to continue to serve you, and it would be a disservice to yourself to stay and to. Because I think what's going to happen is you're going to regress rather than continue to make progress. And it would be better to stop therapy and give yourself some grace, some compassion, some time, and then seek another therapist who you do feel comfortable with.
And I think it's important to highlight too, this is something I experienced on my journey. And the last time that I was in therapy is that sometimes certain therapists are good for like that portion of our journeys. And then sometimes we outgrow, or maybe outgrow isn't always the right word, but that we don't need that particular type of person for that particular part of our journey anymore. And that's okay too. So talk to us about what you do when you work with your clients. Do you use a specific modality? Do you work with specific tools to help your clients, or is it very, very personalized to that person?
Yeah, before I get into that, actually, I just want to circle back on what you just said. And so, yes, I think sometimes we can outgrow a person or we're just no longer a fit because it's no longer creating the growth and the change within us. But also, really understanding that therapists specialize in very different things. And so, somebody who specializes or does psychotherapy or what is really known as talk therapy, especially for trauma, that is not always the best modality. And there are other better modalities for trauma. One that I did for quite some time was EMDR. I know the military and VA were really pushing prolonged exposure, which has come out more recently as not being as beneficial as they once thought it was, which is really unfortunate. But there is a lot of research that backs up EMDR. And, again, I think finding somebody who specializes in trauma, if you've experienced trauma, is really important. In terms of the work that I do, I no longer practice therapy. So I'm not working as a therapist. I do work as a coach with women and specifically focusing on the growth and empowerment so that they can create healthy relationships. I am a huge believer in therapy. And so I do think that there are certain things that we need to see a skilled therapist for. And then I like to consider myself kind of that next step. So when you're ready to really start pursuing that personal growth that's going to be alongside healing, but you've already started a lot of that underlying healing work. And really focusing on this ability to thrive. And so in order to do that, we have to be willing to accept our past. And I don't mean that by saying that we have to be okay with it, but we have to know that what happened happened and we can't go back and change it, but we can change how our future unfolds for us. And so that's really the pivotal point where I like to get in and support and, you know, call the coach, but I really love seeing it as kind of this side-by-side facilitation.
Why did you make the switch from therapy to coaching?
I actually left therapy quite some time ago, many years ago, and in part because I started working with all of the branches, and I was working in research and doing some education for the military around brain injury. And that just kind of evolved into some tech and innovation. And so my day job, I still work with veterans and do the tech side where I get to weigh in from my clinical expertise. But there are a lot of limitations when it comes to therapy. And for me, I wasn't able to serve in the way that I wanted to. Because I'm still licensed, I do have a scope that I have to stay within, which is very different from other coaches. However, you know, the insurance rules and regulations, and I feel like therapy became a much bigger barrier than coaching. And so that was really my main motivation for changing.
What are those limitations that you talked about?
Yeah, insurance is one. Mental health can be very tough. And so there's a lot of justification that goes in. And within the military, actually, if you are active or if you are a veteran, you have a lot of resources because of your insurance and your benefits if you are registered with the VA. However, as civilians, I don't feel like there are as many options to get support with mental health resources. And if you do go through insurance, the provider also isn't getting compensated well. So by decreasing that barrier, it kind of evens out so that as a coach, I can get paid, you know, a reasonable rate. And then as somebody seeking support, you also get your needs met without having to go through submitting bills and making sure that stuff is justified and making sure that you get reimbursed and all of those different things.
So kind of going off alongside that, what are some solutions that you think would help get, like, maybe not get rid of the barriers completely, because I don't see that happening anytime in the near future, but solutions that you think would make ease of access better, especially on the civilian side for mental health resources. And we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about this, but I'm just curious from your standpoint, what your thoughts are.
You know, it's interesting. I haven't really looked at it so much from the civilian side, but it probably mirrors a lot of my thoughts on the veteran side of things. And I think a lot of the policies and regulations are so deeply embedded in systems that it gets really challenging to figure out where you can start to truly create change.
That's a good answer. And is that the same thought that you have on the veteran side too?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone told me the other day that there's, like, I think like 300 plus policies that deal with mental health in some way in the government, dealing with the military specifically, and they're all kind of their own little niche thing. And so that fits so well when you talk about systems, because I think sometimes systems can not be beneficial when systems aren't, like, working together as a well-oiled machine, and they're kind of all in their own little niches and brackets of the government. And so it's interesting that you bring that up. So as far as the clients that you do work with, what are some success stories that you've had?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really stress is redefining success. And of course, I speak about it in terms of thriving. And so really understanding what thriving means to you. And So my caveat with that is I don't always think a long-term relationship meets the definition of success. So what I have found is I do have many clients who come back and say, you know, I have found this relationship and I wouldn't have been able to show up the way that I do had it not been for the work that I did on myself. And I think likewise, you know, teaching women how to feel safe to be themselves and to speak up for themselves, whether that means staying in a relationship or being able to advocate for themselves enough to leave a relationship, those are two very key components for me in terms of what I would deem as successful.
That's awesome. And so do you get a lot of like domestic violence survivors and people that have dealt with really traumatic relationship-based issues in their life?
I haven't actually received many domestic violence clients. I really see a lot of women who've experienced narcissistic abuse and toxic relationships. And whether that is, again, the fear and the stigma of admitting or labeling it as abuse, you know, I think there's a lot of shame that comes with that. And so I haven't seen them, at least in terms of what they report out.
Yeah, and you know, I would think, I guess in my definition, I would think that narcissistic abuse would fall somewhere under the umbrella of domestic violence or domestic abuse too, because having been through narcissism in relationships like that in the past with people that I've dealt with, whether in a direct relationship or in other areas, you know, that those things can be really hard to get away from. And then you talked about the shame piece, which is, you know, something that lasts usually well beyond that relationship until we start to work on those things that can be really uncomfortable to work on. So
You're right.
I love, love, love that you help women in that space because it's so needed and it can be a tough thing to deal with in therapy sometimes. I'm a huge, huge advocate for coaches because I think that a coaching relationship is just for some people more comfortable. And we don't have to, you know, worry about like, oh, I'm going to go in and sit in an office and have to like dive deep into the things I don't want to dive deep into right now in this moment. Maybe we can just work on like the positive things. And so, not to say that hard stuff doesn't come up with coaching too, but it's just a different dynamic, I think. And I love that that's become more prevalent in our society with, you know, pushing this coach aspect as well as the therapy aspect. So talk to us a little bit about your book that you wrote.
Yeah, thank you. So it is called Rise Up and Thrive: How to Break Cycles of Toxic and Traumatic Relationships to Create Healthy Love. And it really is a combination of my personal story along with strategies that I've learned in my own process, as well as really the themes and patterns that have come up, not just for me, but for the women that I have worked with and that I've witnessed. And so really I start from the end of my marriage. And I've always been an avid journaler. And so every chapter actually starts off with one to two chapters or one to two journal entries that have been completely unedited, of the raw and real experience. And in part because I think, well, I'll back up a little bit. When I first wrote the first iteration of this book, I was very dissatisfied with it because I realized it was so formal and so much of a how-to, and there was zero personal connection. And I thought, I wouldn't want to read a book like that. So why would I expect anybody else to? Like, I want to know that somebody feels what I'm feeling and that they actually can help me move forward instead of just telling me, oh, follow steps one through five and not knowing if they've ever experienced the same thing. So I start every chapter with these raw, real journal entries. I give a little story. I share some strategy. I give what I call a wink at the end of every chapter. So it's what I now know. So it's me now reflecting back on that situation. And then almost every chapter ends with an activity, a reflection, journal prompts. And if you purchase the book, there's also a link to a 60 plus page free workbook that goes along with the book.
So it's very much an interactive book.
Absolutely.
I love that.
I think that's how we learn best, honestly.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then you also have your podcast. Talk to us about that.
I do. Yeah. So my podcast is called Rise Up Thriving, and it's primarily women coming on to share their stories of overcoming adversity, overcoming trauma, whatever kind of challenging experiences they've had. And I don't limit those stories because, again, one of my key pieces is I feel like women too often suffer in silence. And so I really love when women are willing to open up and share about their own story, because I know somebody listening is going to be able to relate and feel that connection and feel hopeful about their own future. So we do have some stories of domestic violence, but we also have miscarriages. We have, trying to think what some of the other ones have been, loss of a spouse or a parent or a child, all various types of challenges that come up in life. And my ask for every guest on the podcast is that they are on the other side. You know, again, healing is an evolving journey, but I don't want people speaking from their wounds. I truly do believe in speaking from our scars. And every episode gives tangible tips on how to get through a situation if you're experiencing something similar.
I love that you used the words from scars instead of wounds, because it speaks to the fact that there's still going to be a scar there, but the place that we come from with a wound versus a scar is two completely different places. So love that you used that, had to highlight that one. What is your, I will say, five-year goal? 5 years from now, where do you hope to see yourself?
Ooh. My biggest dream and the biggest dream really with this book was to be able to impact so many other people's lives. And again, you know, I truly believe that the teacher appears when the student is ready. And I know that there are some people who have likely heard similar messages to that I share in my book. And I know that my story will impact people. And I also know my story. If somebody is willing to read the book, they don't need to have gone through the same situation or even a similar situation to me. There's a lot of tangible healing strategies throughout the book that are situation agnostic, if you will. You know, you can have gone through anything in life and still hopefully find it beneficial. So my wish, desire would be to speak on stages, get my book in the hands of women and men, honestly, and be able to connect with people and really have those deep conversations. Those intimate connections for me are super powerful. And then a couple years ago, I said one of my dreams was to have a place called the Healing House. And I would love to have something of a safe refuge for women and their children who are just getting out of abusive relationships.
I love that. And I'm looking forward to that happening for you, because that will definitely happen. I see it in your soul and your energy and the way that you show up in the world. And I'm so excited to continue to watch you grow. Who has been a mentor or someone that's been really influential in your journey up to this point?
It's funny, you know, I think this sounds so cliche, but it really was my grandma, and especially her final years of life. We just got so close, and she was even on my podcast. I had enough, you know, knowledge and insight that she wasn't going to be around forever. So just wanted to really capture her stories, but she was such a different woman. I mean, she became a widow at 44 and never remarried. And just the strength that I believed she embodied was very inspirational for me. And she really accomplished a lot in her life that I have wanted to mimic and, you know, be able to do something similar.
I love that. And I love that you captured her story, knowing that, you know, we're humans, we don't live forever. And so there's something so beautiful about being able to capture the knowledge and and insights and wisdom of really anyone that's in the last few years of their life, because there's so much we can learn from that. So I will have to go back and listen to that episode because now I'm really excited to hear it. Well, Christina, I wanted to make sure that I give you a time here to tell people where they can find you, where they can support you, and then we will wrap up the episode here shortly. But tell the people, you do have your website, social media, anywhere people can find you, support you, and especially grab a copy of your book.
Amazing. Yes, thank you. My book is available on Amazon in both paperback and ebook versions. I don't know how much longer we will have it there, but right now for the ebook version, it is only 99 cents. So really, again, just wanted to get it in as many hands as possible. And I believe that it can create change. And even if you don't feel like it can for you, if you think of somebody that it can, it's a dollar. So it is available on Amazon. You probably have to type in the full title, which is Rise Up and Thrive. You can connect with me on Instagram. That's where I'm most active, and it is Rise with Christina. My podcast is Rise Up Thriving, and it's available on all platforms. And then I also, just because of the book, created a website that is risewithchristina.com. And again, that's all Christina with a K.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I will make sure to put all that info in the show notes for anyone that just wants a quick and easy link to get there. Please make sure you support. It's a dollar to grab a copy of the book. And like Christina said, even if you don't think that it will support you specifically, there's probably someone in your life who it will support. But I truly believe that by reading other people's stories, we just learn more about the world around us. We learn more about human beings and people's experiences. And there's so much power in a story. That's the whole basis of this podcast. I think there's power in that. So please make sure you go to Amazon, grab a copy of the book, and support Christina and the work that she is doing, sharing her incredible message with the world. Christina, to wrap up today, first of all, thank you again for being here and for sharing your incredible story and talking a little bit about your book and what you are doing. And oh, before I forget, what if someone wants to work with you on a coaching standpoint?
Yes. So both, again, Instagram, Rise with Christina, or risewithchristina.com, and both have ways that you can connect with me.
Okay, perfect. I wanted to make sure I got that in there in case it was something different, because that's important too. And there's likely someone listening in that could use your help or your assistance, or if anything, just follow, because social media, following, liking, all that stuff is free. And so I'll always push that. Go to her podcast, listen to it, like it, give it a 5-star review, all the things. Please support. We're all about it here. Last question. Is there any last words or pieces of advice that you want to leave the listeners with today?
Yeah, I think what's coming up for me, and I mentioned it earlier in our conversation, is I really believe that no matter your past circumstances, you have the ability and the responsibility to choose how you want to define your future.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today, with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.